Well, thank you, of course, Martin and Anna, for graciously inviting us. We are delighted and honored to be here today. What we'd like to do is to just present to you some work that we've been doing for about the past 3 years. Walter and I have engaged in an interdisciplinary project where we are formulating a divine action account of the basic concepts in science and mathematics. And so our divine action account is called divine compositionalism, and in just a moment I'm going to turn it over to Walter, and he will describe for you divine compositionalism. If you're interested, we just published a paper in 2014 in the journal Theology and Science, and that describes the account divine compositionalism in more detail, but Walter will give you an overview. And he will show you how our view of divine action is rooted in a theistic account of causation dispositions. But we're particularly interested in how this divine action account can be applied to scientific mechanisms. And so after Walter's finished giving you the background information on the model, then I'll come back to you again and describe for you a particular model that we have worked out in great detail. We'll be applying divine compositionalism to a basic mechanism in science, which is the sodium chloride cycle in nature. Now, this model we worked out about 3 years ago. We want to start with something really simple and something very basic just to get our methodology down. But since then, we have actually devised an account of higher order complex biological mechanisms, two in particular. One, we have applied divine compositionalism to the troponin-tropomyosin cycle in muscle contraction. And we've also applied it to the visual perception system in the vertebrate eye, the molecular mechanism of vision in the vertebrate eye. So those are more complex mechanisms. So we thought we'd kind of keep it simple today and just show you our methodology, and then hopefully we'll have lots of time later for some discussion for you to engage with us about the method. Oh, and I do have handouts here for any of you that are muscle-minded people. I'll pass these around. We won't be covering this handout today. It's just for you to look at if you have interest in muscle contraction and divine action. So it's all yours, Walter.
Okay, so what I'll do is just give a basic overview of the metaphysics. Okay, so as Lisa mentioned, this paper arose out of a larger project begun more than 10 years ago, which was an attempt to account for the fundamental concepts of both science and math in terms of divine action. So here's a slide that has the same information right there. We want to start from theology, and if you start from exegetical and biblical theology, and what that says about God's relationship to nature, it indicates, just suggests, that nature depends entirely on God's sustaining divine action. So if we then, on the other side, have fields of study, basic science, and then mathematics, and here's some basic concepts: time, space, event, causation, disposition, law of nature, and mechanism I have highlighted for a particular reason. Of course, we could add more concepts, but just a handful of concepts from mathematics: numbers, sets, and shapes, groups, rings, fields, and many more. And then shared terms: object, field, property, relation, necessity, proposition. So our project has been, is it possible to give an account of all of that? All of that in terms of divine action, not just one or two, but all of them. And as I say, that's been the project for about 10 years. The larger project began as an attempt by myself to overcome problems facing, I'm reading from the handout now, extant analyses of dispositional properties. I'll say a little bit more about that later, and led to a new semantics for second order modal logic, a new account of so-called abstract objects, a theory of truth and truth making, and more. And then 3 years ago, Dr. Winslow and I began this collaboration to give a rigorous divine action conceptualization of biological and chemical mechanisms. Here's a quote that stuck with us. Einstein wrote to Schrodinger in 1935 saying, "The real difficulty lies in the fact that physics is a kind of metaphysics. Physics describes reality, but we do not know what reality is. We know it only by the means of physical description." So Lisa Ann and I think reality is a matter of divine action, and we're trying to work that out, see where that goes. So some introduction here. Even though theistic philosophers and metaphysically interested theistic scientists agree that reality is a matter of divine action, God created, sustains, providentially governs the world, they disagree over how to understand divine sustaining action in relation to causation, and of course dispositions and then law of nature and much more. At least since the 13th century, the major competing theories of divine action among Christian theologians and philosophers have been deism, mere conservationism, concurrentism, and occasionalism. And just to show you how they fit, you could put them on a continuum. A succinct way to summarize deism is that God neither sustains nor causes any event. At the other end of the continuum is occasionalism, which would say that God sustains and is the sole cause of every event in the natural order. Then closer to deism is mere conservationism, which holds that God sustains but does not cause any event in the natural order. And then in between those two is concurrentism, that God sustains and cooperatively causes every event in the natural order. Our view, divine compositionalism, actually fits between those two, if you just to kind of put that in the continuum of views of divine action. And we're claiming that the way to look at it is that God sustains and is the sole cause of every physical event that's important, and such divine willing constitutes the natural order. And we call this divine compositionalism. Mauro Dorado writes, "It is reasonable to follow Bell and assume that physical space-time is to be regarded as the set of all flashes or localizations occurring at a precise location at a certain time. On our view, such localizations are the elementary micro-creations of God, which, when combined in increasingly and exceedingly complex ways, constitute the entire universe at a moment in time. On this hypothesis, space is background independent and relational. A macroscopic object in space is a unity or configuration of manifesting dispositions, which is a matter of God's coordinating his existence-conferring action. Thus, when the universe is viewed this way, the physical world is God acting compositionally at every Planck moment." So now let me just sort of spell out the ontology. I'm just going from theories of divine action, now the ontology we've worked out. As I said before, we want to root this in biblical theology. And biblical theology involves, first of all, God. And so we take that as God as one of a kind in our ontology. Secondly, theology involves, in many different ways, the notion that God's awareness of his omnicompetence. Not only is God omnicompetent, but he's aware of it. And so from that, that suggests an ordered domain of real possibilities. Biblical theology involves God's commitments to act ad extra on condition. God's acting ad extra, it just means for God acting outside of himself. And for us, we take the word act, we use the word act to mean confer existence. So to do that on condition, we think you can conceive that as dispositions. So far we have three components in our ontology: God, an ordered domain of possibilities, and dispositional properties. But then biblical theology also suggests that God acts ad extra constantly, which we say, why not conceive those as forces, and God's commitments to act ad extra in a coordinated way, which we take as structures. So we have a five-category ontology: God, an ordered domain of possibilities, dispositions, forces, and structures. Now the test is, okay, can you account for those concepts in science, space, time, the law of nature, and so on, and what a number is, what sets are, and the shared concepts? Can you do that? That's a challenge. So we've been working on that for 10 years, and so we have this coordinated cluster of thoughts on that. The domain of possibilities is the content and extent of God's eternal awareness of God's omnicompetence. That's our hypothesis. One sequence of such possibilities is God's composite plan for the universe, which we refer to as the actual world, the components of which are world states. Dispositions, forces, and structures, then again, are ways God acts or confers existence or enacts his plan. The four forces are God's constant actings. A structure, again, is God's unifying, coordinated acting, which we perceive as a pattern of coexistence. For example, a simultaneous aspect of a physical system, or as the co-occurrence of separate events. Both the actual world and God's commitments to act on condition are governed by and subordinated to God's original ultimate end in creation. So our thesis then is this, put succinctly, we postulate that all fundamental concepts of both science and math can be accounted for in terms of some combination of this five-category ontology. If this conceptualization is on the right track, then we may say that what physical science studies are the ways God confers existence according to plan. So then, to move now from that to our metaphysics of causation, to say it succinctly, I'm just defining them very quickly and succinctly without a long discussion that appeared in the paper that we had on the website. An event understood scientifically as a sequence of states of a physical system, perceived as a change, conceived as a manifesting complex of dispositional properties, is really a divinely realized composite world state. Causation is a matter of God speaking, thinking, imagining, creating, whatever word you like, or conferring existence. Causation is God's conferring existence. The causing, the producing, the bringing about of an event is God's realizing a composite world state. Now let me just develop that a little bit with four theses. The apparently causal relation between events is not the real productive causation. Point two, the causing, the producing, the bringing about, or the making happen is God's existence conferring action. Physical causation seems primitive or basic and resists reductive analyses because it is not a productive relation by, of, or between purely physical things. Causation is God's compositionally conferring existence according to his commitments, and all of this is according to the actual world, which is according to his plan. Thus, in our view, causation is not in nature, it grounds nature. Point three, the productive causation of an event, then, on that view, is simultaneous with the occurring of the effect. Four, the causal relation between events is a real relation of necessity by virtue of the irresistibility of God's conditional commitment. Actually, both dispositions and structures have a modal aspect. Both are ways God confers existence, and are, in some cases, what must be, and in other cases, what cannot be. For example, the latter, Pauli's exclusion principle, two identical fermions cannot occupy the same quantum state simultaneously. In short, natural necessity is not a primitive of nature, but is really an aspect of the ways God confers existence. Okay, with that in mind, I just want to develop a specific definition of cause on page 3 of that handout. We would say, then, a discrete event, E1, causes event, E2, just in case God's coordinated existence-conferring act 1 is event E1, which satisfies the set of initiating conditions attached to God's commitment to act 2 on condition. And where such a divine existence-conferring act 2 is each sequential state of the relevant physical system picked out as E2. Okay, some observations at this point. First, these divine commitments, experienced, perceived, or discovered by us as dispositions, laws of succession, or mechanisms, have ranges and degrees of manifestations and of initiating conditions. Second, there usually are several jointly pertinent commitments which together are relevant to an effect, and this is what Lisanne will show with the mechanism of sodium chloride. Third, given such ranges and degrees of both manifestations and initiating conditions,
and the coordinating of multiple relevant divine commitments. Prediction of what particular outcome will occur is often difficult, if not impossible. And fourth, since an event is a sequence of discrete states of a physical system, and causing is simultaneous with effect, then, on our view, there's a complementarity or duality of act and result of God's existence conferring action. And this is then consistent with scripture and tradition, which teaches that physical existence is the result only of God's creative acts. And God requires no help, no instruments, no pre-existing stuff. The creation is created ex nihilo and is never self-existent. In the paper, we show how this view of causation overcomes a contingent of contiguity objection and overcomes a light cone objection. But I'd like to just focus on three slides now to maybe say this again in a summary way so we can take it to its application to dispositional properties. It's mistaken, in summary, to conceptualize two causally related states of physical systems or events as this one causes that one. On our view, it's mistaken to say that. Where the right arrow represents that would represent the productive causality, and we would read it as X causes that. Rather, causation is better conceptualized as in this graphic representation, where the vertical arrow represents God's causing both. God causes this one, and then God causes that one on this view. And where the right arrow represents God's commitment. This one satisfies a set of initiating conditions, triggers the commitment, and this happens. Okay, to continue, in summary then, while causation is God's realizing a plan, the acting, an event is God's realization of a plan, the result. The causal relation is God's commitment. Okay? With that in mind, I'm going to come to dispositional properties a moment. The history of trying to give an analysis of dispositional properties is quite rich, I suppose, beginning with Carnap's criticism of the material conditional analysis all the way up through. But what you can distill from that history is that there are at least five adequacy conditions. If you're going to give an analysis of dispositional properties, and then what it is to say that something has a disposition, it has to satisfy these. Our claim is that what I'm about to show you satisfies these. That's it. Okay, so none of this is new to you, but maybe the language is slightly different. You're used to the word powers here. We're using the word disposition. A disposition, subjectively considered, is a state of being poised to effect a change or be changed. On our view, a disposition, objectively considered, is one of God's conditional commitments to act on condition. Okay, just to take this now one step further, I'm going to say something about that symbolism in a moment. I'm going to be heavy slogging right here, and I'll skim some of it, but this is an important piece for us. For any physical system, object or substance, X, any state of physical system, sigma, X, any disposition, D, and any duration, delta, physical system, X, has disposition, D, over delta, if and only if, one, the actual world includes a representation for a type of causal process associated with this, with D, and holding for some duration delta, within which a state of a physical system X satisfies a set of D's initiating conditions over some duration delta prime. And state of physical system X prime is a token of one of D's manifestation types occurring over duration delta double prime later than that. Okay, now here's one way to look at it. Okay, so the soldier realizes he's going to be on guard duty for 3 hours. So he says to himself, from midnight to 3 in the morning,
Whenever I hear an unidentified rustling across the other side of the fence, then I will blow the whistle. So this just expresses the soldier's commitment to act. It's just like that. Okay, so that's condition one, when to say that something has a dispositional property. And then we go on to say, and exactly one of the following holds. I won't read all of this, but let me just read the second condition. The actual world does not include a representation for which some system actually does satisfy the set of initiating conditions. Therefore, we can say that a physical system X has a dispositional property D just in case one and two hold, so that it's not manifested. It still has a property, but even it's not manifested. And then one and three hold so that it is manifested. And then there are cases where there's the feints and mimickers and so on that's in the literature, where one and four hold so that D is not manifested. So in a very short nutshell, that's our analysis of dispositions. So here's the point. In other words, whether or not a physical system has a dispositional property really is a matter of what the actual world includes. Condition one is important, that the actual world includes a representation for a type of process. And this differentiates this analysis from all other analysis and prevents this one from holding vacuously. And we say it satisfies those adequacy conditions. And I'd just like to finish by maybe sort of wrapping this up in one simple famous example of fragility. When everyone talks about powers and dispositions, fragility and solubility are the two that come up, right? Okay, so here's an actual world in a fragile vase. At T1, the fragile vase is subject to stress. We can represent it this way. The actual world includes some state at that duration that satisfies that. At T2, the fragile vase shatters. We can represent that similarly. The actual world includes the same system, but later, to mark it off, at a later duration. All right, now, why does the vase shatter? On one account, it shatters because it's in a state of being poised to be changed. That's true. Why does it shatter? Well, it shatters because it has a disposition of fragility. That's true. What we're trying to add to that is that it's God's commitment is really underneath this whole thing. And what joins those, that this one down here happens to satisfy the initiating conditions of fragility, and this one is right here, it's a token of one of the manifestations of fragility. Needless to say, you might guess that we think pan-dispositionalism is the right view. All natural properties are dispositional. We won't talk about that unless someone wants to bring it up with Q&A. What I'd like to do right now is turn this over to my colleague to show how we've applied this model to a very simple mechanism in science.
All right, well, Walter just provided you with some substantial background in the theistic metaphysics that the model divine compositionalism is grounded in. But this is all quite esoteric, you know, and so we try to find these real-world examples like the soldier or the vase, try to wrap our mind around this. Well, remember, our original goal was to see if we could provide an account of the basic concepts of science and mathematics using this model. So in order to do that, we went to actual real-world scientific mechanisms, right? Why not, right? So let's just go to the science and see if we can use divine compositionalism as a hypothesis and then test it using real-world scientific mechanisms that you would find in a chemistry or biology textbook, the ones that I teach in my biology department back at Northwestern. So what I'd like to do is just to give you a little bit of background using a generic, just to remind you of what a scientific mechanism is, and then we're going to focus in on the sodium chloride cycle in nature. Well, what we discovered when we were reading the metaphysics literature, the philosophical metaphysics literature of what is a scientific mechanism in the philosophy of science literature, what we noticed in our readings was that there were huge disparities in agreement in what a scientific mechanism is. What we noticed is the discrepancies in the description of a scientific mechanism, in particular in what the causation is. What is causing X to change into or become Y in a chemical reaction or in a mechanism in nature? And so Walter brought out some of this terminology earlier. The terms that are used are what is the causation? What is the causal process? What are the powers involved? What brings about the reaction? What is the producer in the reaction? So the terminology is all over the map in the scientific mechanism literature. And when we were reading this, we said, you know, our hunch on divine compositionalism might actually contribute to this conversation and provide an alternative view of what the causality really is in a scientific mechanism in the real world, okay? So we're gonna start with a very basic model of a mechanism. So we have state A is going to change into or become state B, you know, and in some mechanisms in the world, it stops there. That's the end of the reaction. You put sugar in your coffee, you stir it, and then it becomes sweet. It's done. However, most mechanisms, particularly the higher order biological mechanisms, are many steps. So many biochemical pathways in our bodies are 18 or 19 steps. And step A leads to step B, but then step B becomes the starting material for the next step, C, and then maybe there's 15 more of those arrows leading down a biochemical pathway. So let's say for this very simple example, just to orient our minds to a scientific mechanism, states A, B, and C of system X is involved in a two-step mechanism, okay? So the first step would be A going to B, the second step of the mechanism is B going to C, and then the reaction is done. So state A, we would term that the initiating condition. The initiating condition is what starts the reaction going. Then state B is the termination of the first step of the reaction, which, as I said, could stop there for some mechanisms, or perhaps could serve as the intermediate, which would represent then the starting material, the initiating condition for the next step in the reaction. Now, what I'd like to point out is those capital D1 and D2. What we're saying is that for a scientific mechanism, the entity involved or the substance involved has a certain disposition. The disposition represents God's acting upon a certain condition. So D1 in our model, D1 and D2, so the disposition of substance A to manifest into substance B, and then the substance D2 would be substance B having a certain disposition that allows it to then manifest into C. So the dispositions D1 and D2 in our model represent God's commitment to act upon a certain condition, which would be the little bracket I, whatever those that range of initiating conditions are, and then it'll result in some range of manifestations. Sometimes the range of manifestations M only equals one in our perception. Sometimes there's only one end product to a certain reaction. Sometimes there could be many. And that range of manifestations is basically God's plan for the universe. So for our conceptualization of a scientific mechanism, represented in this way, a mechanism is basically a structure of manifesting dispositions. Okay? So with that background of a generic scientific mechanism, we're going to go through our specific model of the sodium chloride cycle, which happens in nature. But before we do this, I'm going to give you all chemistry 101 lesson. So just the basic chemistry. You know, anybody here like salt on your, what do you call them here? Chips?
Yes.
We call them French fries. Okay. So you like salt on your chips, right? So you just sprinkle it all. What are you sprinkling on there? You're sprinkling a little white crystal onto your chips, and you put it into your mouth, and it has a certain flavor, okay? Well, that stuff in that little salt shaker came from big, huge chunks of rock that's present in the geological rock of the world, okay? So the sodium chloride cycle is a very complicated cycle. It starts out with sodium chloride solid, which we have here as NaClS, which is halite rock, That's embedded in the earth's crust. That's harvested, you know, to make your table salt. But in the natural world, what happens is there's an initiating condition that happens to that that rock salt that's embedded in the natural world, and it's just wind and rain and ice melting and hail. It's erosion, just basic erosion is an initiating condition. And what will happen to those big flat beds of halite or rock salt is they will chip off and flake off and chunk off into sodium chloride crystals. And then the sodium chloride crystals will somehow find their way into some form of water system in the natural world. We just call that, you know, runoff, okay? So it runs off, it erodes, it runs off, it gets into the water system, lakes and streams and rivers, eventually into the ocean. And those crystals will break down into the molecule sodium chloride. And little AQ means it's in aqueous solution, it's in water. But immediately, as soon as this crystal structure, this lattice, breaks down into individual molecules, they are then subject to water. And I'm going to talk about the chemistry of water in just a minute. But when sodium chloride molecules in water, an instantaneous reaction occurs. This molecule will then ionize. So here you have your sodium chloride molecule in water. Instantaneously, it will break down into the two ions, sodium cation and chloride anion. So when you eat your chips, what you're doing is you're sprinkling this onto your chips. You put it in your mouth, which is now an aqueous solution. And immediately, as soon as it hits the aqueous solution of your mouth, that's going to happen. And this is what you're tasting, is the metallic taste of the sodium positively charged ion. See, now you can impress your friends when you go out to dinner tonight. You can explain this to them, okay? But this is a cycle. So in the ocean, when, let's say, you're at the beach, and I'm a marine biologist for 25 years, so I'm at the edge of the sea quite often, usually with boots up to here, you know, wading around. But I notice on my day at the sea that there's lots of waves, and they're crashing on the rocks, and it's a really hot, sunny day, just like you have here in Oxford all the time, right? So the sun begins to evaporate the seawater. And when the solar energy hits those water molecules, they evaporate. And so now what happens is if we have these guys who are in water, and the water begins to evaporate, the reaction will now go into the opposite direction, and you will have sodium chloride molecules will reform, and I'll explain that chemistry in just a moment. And when that happens, then the sodium chloride will formulate a higher order lattice crystal structure, which in my lab at Northwestern, since you know we are in Minnesota, which is right in the middle of North America, go to a map and you will see that a marine biologist is doing marine biology as far away from an ocean as you can get on the continent of North America, okay? So I have a lot of seawater in my lab, and I've got a 180-gallon gorgeous marine reef aquarium, you know, with all kinds of critters in it. But one of the problems in my lab is that the water in the tank, because the filters are running and they're splashing, and there's always salt crystals on my glass, and I hate it. So I have to hire TAs who come in, they clean it off every day so it looks really pretty. So what's happening is when the salt comes out into the air, the salt water comes out into the air, water evaporates, and then we have the crystals forming, the white sodium chloride crystals that you notice in your little jar of salt, and then they will form higher order structures in the natural world and form halite beds. So you see we have this complete sodium chloride cycle in nature. So the original sodium chloride halite rock salt beds that are in the world came from millions of years ago when oceans evaporated and those huge large salt beds formed from the evaporation of the sodium chloride from the seawater. And then so we have this cycle in nature, okay? So we decided to take this very simple this very simple mechanism and try to see if we can test divine compositionalism from a real-world mechanism. But I have to tell you one other thing before we leave the chemistry, okay? And I hope this hasn't been too much agony for you. So here, let's just pretend, here's the crystal structure. So in your salt crystal, in your salt shaker, you have a higher order crystal where you've got sodium chloride individual molecules which are all bound to each other in a stable lattice structure. And then when you put that into water, what will happen is the water will compete for these individual crossing bonds so that you'll get individual molecules released. But water has a very powerful effect, and this is the one aspect of our mechanism that's not shown on here that Dr. Schultz and I have been working through, is that we have to take into account the disposition of water. The reason why the disposition of water is so crucial to this mechanism is because water is a very interesting molecule chemically. Water has an oxygen, you know, it's H2O, so we have this large oxygen molecule, these two small hydrogen atoms that are covalently bound. But what happens with the electrons in this molecule is because oxygen is so much larger than the two hydrogens, it has a very, very largely positive nucleus. And so the electrons, as they orbit around this molecule, they're going to want to spend more time around that largely positive nucleus. So it gives water a two-sided flavor, if you will. Overall, water is a neutral, you know, it's a neutral substance. But when you look at it on a more fine-tuned chemical basis, it has what's called a dipole moment. So this half of the oxygen half of the molecule has a partial negative charge. And the hydrogen side has two partial positive charges. So it gives you two flavors to the molecule, a partial negative side and a partial positive side. This is crucial for the ionization of sodium chloride in water, because once you have water, so the sodium chloride touches your tongue, or the sodium chloride crystal gets into a river, whatever it is, all of these billions and billions and billions of water molecules all having these partial negative and partial positive sides competes for the sodium and the chloride and pulls them apart. So the whole molecule is saturated with water molecules, all with their negative side pointed down. Likewise, chloride, the partial positive charge is facing in. So now you've got a hydration layer, a layer around each of these ions, preventing them from forming that bond. The only way to reform that bond would be to evaporate, get rid. You get an A on today's chem test, all right? So if you get rid of the water molecules by evaporation, you'll notice if I get rid of them one by one, because it's a hot, sunny day on the beach, then what happens is I now have removed the competitors, and now that positive-negative interaction can reform that bond. And then when that happens, it's going to form that crystal, okay? So this is a naturally occurring cycle in nature. All right. Where do we see God's acting in this mechanism? We are trying to say, where's God? Where's God acting? We are saying every single component of this multi-step mechanism, it's a three-step mechanism, each component has a certain disposition. That disposition is representing God's commitment to act upon a certain condition. Okay, so that would be the very, that if you look on the five category ontology, the dispositions of each state of the system is God acting upon condition. Well, there are forces that are involved here too. There are forces that are holding the crystal lattice together. There are forces that are holding sodium and chloride together in an ionic bond. And there are forces here that are preventing them from being together in an ionic bond, being solubilized, okay, dissolving. Those forces, we are saying then, would be God acting ad extra constantly. And then we see that there are structures involved here. There's a sodium chloride lattice structure. There is a sodium chloride molecule, which is a structure. Each individual atom, we can take this all the way down to the bottom out level, and what you continue to get, no matter how far down you go to the bottom out level, you continually get God acting upon condition. So we would say that our structures here would be God acting ad extra, coordinately, coordinating God's acting to form the structures that are involved in the mechanism, okay? So with that background, let's just turn to the full sodium chloride cycle, okay? I'm only going to do the first half, which is just the ionization in water for you, all right? So let's begin with disposition D1 of sodium chloride halite, which is the rock salt, existing in soil and in rock. In this state, sodium chloride solid halite has the disposition to be eroded under certain startup conditions. This is represented in the formulation as situation X is a member of a set of initiating conditions under some duration of time. So if we just flesh that out in actual world science, we could say there's a wide range of startup conditions in this mechanism I that would include, but are clearly not limited to, wind and rain and sleet and ice melt and earthquakes and hurricanes and tornadoes, all kinds of environmental conditions. God's acting creates a set of startup conditions I over a time duration delta prime in the physical world. In this system, the time duration can be very long epochs of time, millions of years for erosion to happen, or shorter periods of time depending on the environmental conditions. The physical system has these dispositional properties that the actual world includes. Since the actual world is God's plan according to which God confers existence, we may apply a conception of God's creative acting according to plan, construed as God's commitment to act on condition to D1, specifically of solid sodium chloride to erode under certain startup conditions. Now, the manifestation, M, of the disposition of sodium rock salt to erode, ontologically considered, also represents a wide range of possibilities that would include the size of the eroded fragments, the dimensions of the crystal lattice structure, and so on. This would represent the range of God's freedom to act according to condition. Since we see this regularly, we see the regularity of erosion throughout nature, we construe this as God's consistent acting. Now in disposition D2, so if you look on the board, now what we've done, we've done so far is we've eroded halite into smaller sodium crystals. That's how that's harvested to get into your salt shaker. So D2 now is, we're taking the second step of the mechanism. In the disposition D2, however, we see the multi-step complex causal process continue as the manifestation of D1 becomes the startup condition for the next step in the mechanism. So in D2, the disposition of sodium chloride crystals to be dissolved into individual sodium chloride molecules under certain startup conditions is also represented in the formulation of a situation X, satisfies a set of initiating conditions. However, now it's delta prime 2, because it has to be happening later than the initial step of the reaction. And again, we have a range of startup conditions in this mechanism, so you can see how we're testing our hypothesis. And the testing of the hypothesis, it seems to really work. We're taking a real live, right now, this is happening everywhere on Earth, and we can apply the formulation almost perfectly to an actual scientific mechanism. So the range of startup conditions in the mechanism here for the second step would include, but it's not limited to, various forms of exposure to aqueous solutions, rivers, lakes, raindrops, your mouth, saliva, all kinds, right? So you can see how the eye is a wide range for this step. But we thought maybe it would be easier to just simplify it further and say that eye equals one. There's only really one initiating condition, which is simply exposure of sodium chloride crystals to water of any sort. Okay, so we can kind of pare it down a little bit. So we construe this as God's acting upon an included set of startup conditions I over a time duration delta prime prime, which is represented in the actual world. And again, we can apply a conception of D2, disposition D2, which now the disposition is different. It's specifically dissolving sodium chlorides into free sodium chloride molecules, individual molecules, under these startup conditions, and we apply that to a conception of God's creative acting according to plan, and it can be construed as God's commitment to act on that condition. This representation of God's acting now is viewed compositionally because these events are happening in a compositional, coordinated fashion everywhere that these molecules exist and are present under the range of startup conditions everywhere in the world. And the manifestation M of the disposition of salt crystals to dissolve, ontologically considered, also represents a range of possibilities. These likewise represent the range of God's freedom to act according to condition, and the regularity of the manifestation is God's consistent acting. And now finally we see disposition D3. So we're at the very bottom of our mechanism. Now keep in mind, right here between D2 and D3 is where we would probably have to put in the disposition of water. Because for the molecule to ionize, we have to have water. So we're working on that currently. But that would be inserted right here if we had the methodology finished for the disposition of water. But in D3, at least for the sodium chloride mechanism, we see the manifestation of D2 now, which is sodium chloride in aqueous conditions. It becomes the startup condition for the next and the final step in this reaction. In this case, state C, which you can see on the previous stage, is very short-lived. This duration D delta would be very quick, not millions of years like the duration of time for step one. Here, it's very short-lived because the polarity of water, which I described to you on the board, will act immediately on individual sodium chloride molecules, pulling them apart due to that dipole of water, producing the terminating conditions, which is basically the dissolving of salt, which is, in chemical terms, the ionization of sodium ion and chloride ions in the aqueous solution. And there you have it formalized for you. So the disposition of ionization of the cationic sodium and the anionic chloride ions to ionize in aqueous solution, simply stated, simply is God's acting upon commitment under certain startup conditions according to God's plan for the world. The manifestation M in this reaction is a range of possible manifestations where in our experience in the actual world is M equals 1. All we have is a sodium ion and a chloride ion at the very end of the reaction. And we construe this as a regularity representing God's freedom to act according to his purposes and plans. Each step in the multi-step mechanism of the solubility of salt from halite just is God's causally producing acting. Given our analysis of dispositions that Walter went over with you earlier, what really connects the initiating condition to the manifestation, so the horizontal arrow, is God's commitment to act on condition. So thus, if we were to give an account of the causation in the mechanism, and this is how we think maybe we could add to the conversation currently in the understanding of a scientific mechanism in the philosophical literature, is if we're attempting to give an account of what's causing sodium to dissolve. Again, Dr. Schultz said this is a very popular example that's in the dispositions literature out there, dissolving of sugar or dissolving of salt, popular ones. So we have a very different understanding of how we feel the causality is being realized. So if we were to give an account of the causation in the mechanism of the solubility of salt, which in chemical terms is the ionization of sodium chloride from rock salt, the producing, and then again, these are the words that are used, the producing, the bringing about, the causation of dissolving is God's acting or God's realizing this particular actual world state. We never observe causation. It is primitively subjective, but objectively it is God's acting. The mechanism in our model then is simply the manifesting of a complex disposition, which ontologically is God's acting on condition. Or if we can say it another way, efficient causation turns out not to be a fundamental feature of nature. It is not ontologically primitive in a naturalistic sense. What seems to be the causal relation between states of the reaction just is God's realizing both states according to God's established commitments in the natural world. Thus, the cause of halite dissolving into the ions sodium and chloride that are required for oceans to possess their salinity, for cells to function with the required sodium and chloride ions, is a situation that satisfies a condition of one of God's commitments to act on condition. A divine commitment is what links the two states, giving us a causal relation, and when we generalize this, it could give us laws of succession. So according to divine compositionalism, as Dr. Schultz, as Walter described earlier, we would say that it's a mistake to conceptualize two causally related situations. Okay, so you know, if we said that erosion causes halite to form crystals, we would say that that's a mistake to conceptualize it that way. There are no such things in our model, only God's compositional existence-conferring actions through Christ.